Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles range. We have your van.
Time to look back on the week that was, a week in which a teachers' union balloted to strike for a confusing mix of COVID and pay-related concerns. The government argued that Irish law trumped European law on access to mother and baby home archives, until it argued that European law actually trumped Irish law on access to mother and baby home archives. It became clearer that America, the North Star of democratic nations, was gearing up to let lawyers decide rather than the people decide, and we all got on with lockdown version 2.0. but a lot more grumpily. I'm joined by Nasa Harrigan, Green Party TD, Padraig Tobin, ANCTU TD for Meath, and journalist Brenda Power. Glad to see that Nasa Harrigan and Padraig Tobin, who are in here with me, have ignored Damien English's advice that clothing is non-essential and you're all clothed head to toe. Journalist Brenda Power, you could be in your all together at home. How are you doing?
Absolutely. You have no idea and no way of knowing whether I am or not. And I have to say, watching that foot mouth opening and foot moving in moment for poor Damien English last night, I have to say my heart went out to him, because that is a sentence that is going to haunt him for the rest of his days. Clothes are not essential. If you're working from home, you know, possibly not. But most of the time you do actually need clothes. And he was floundering really when trying to explain why children mightn't need socks over the next couple of weeks. I mean, quite possibly, Philip, you know, we all have a lot of clothes and maybe enough. But if there's an urgent need for something, for instance, I was writing about this in my Daily Mail column today. I know somebody who's just recently had a hip replacement, a lady, and she is finding it difficult to put on trousers, so she needed a skirt with an elasticated waist. But when a friend went to try and buy them in Dunn's, even though they were there and they were visible and they were available, she wasn't allowed. So, I mean, those are essentials, those are necessities that it's going to be very difficult to explain to people why for the next 4 to 5 weeks they can't purchase them. And telling people clothes are not essential is really, once you get into that level of absurdity, I'm afraid it's difficult to ensure people's compliance or indeed respect.
Nasa, are we getting this mix of essential and non-essential right?
Well, look, as a parent of 3 kids under 8, socks are essential for me. And I actually think Deputy English might embrace that line. You know, I'll leave it to himself how he might do that. But I think that, look, there's always going to be a negotiation here, because this is, you know, a difficult thing to do. And we're going to have to negotiate out between ourselves what is essential and what is not. And I think Brenda has given you a very good example there of that people have needs. And you know, sometimes there are things happening in your life that you can't necessarily know 6 weeks before when there's a lockdown. And this lockdown is slightly different from the last lockdown. So we have to negotiate through this one in the same way that we did the last one. And that's a case of people saying, look, this doesn't work for me here. I need to get, you know, knickers for my little girl, or I need to get socks for my kids, or I need to get an elasticated waist skirt. And that has to be something where the public, you know, makes their feelings heard to politicians and they react. And you would hope that we are able to do this in a dynamic way, in a reactive way.
Padraig, does it surprise you that we didn't learn more from lockdown version 1.0 that we could have applied to this one?
Well, we've learned very little, and you know, this surreal debate that we're having on whether or not socks are, you know, essential or not, that maybe that there's nearly some kind of black market now for socks at this stage, that we have pro and anti-sock politicians.
I don't think we're there
clashing.
Yet.
No, I saw the front page.
I've got some lovely wool knit that I might be able to interest you in after the programme.
Well, the front page of the RTE website today has, you know, two political parties clashing over socks. And, you know, that shows the surreal nature that we're in at the moment. And there is a serious point to this, and that's the lack of consistency in the application of guidelines across the country from the start of this process has been really difficult. And we heard Kingston Mills earlier on your show talk about the fact that, you know, this illness has come in twice in two different strains from abroad. And yet we have 5 kilometre restrictions for people, you know, in their own counties in travel. And we still have people coming from abroad into this country with little or no restrictions, or little or no follow up, at least, into, you know, where they've come from. Are they self-isolating? Are they doing the right thing? So it's that clash of logic that has really upset a lot of people when it comes to COVID.
Let's turn to the teacher strike, the threatened ASTI strike, because I think that the deadline for those demands that they balloted on to be met runs out at the end of today. How real do you think, Nasa, this threat to strike is?
Look, I don't think anyone strikes for the good of their health. Nobody wants to be striking. And I think that, you know, teachers who are making that decision are doing so because they're at the end of their tether and they feel that they're shouldering too much of the burden. And that, and I think in many cases, they're so frustrated, they feel that their own health is at risk. And so I think whether they're serious or not, the way to avert a strike, and I really hope that we can, is to listen to those concerns because, you know, I kind of dealt with some of the special needs assistants on this issue, but that issue around are you a close contact and testing and the availability of PPE. I know a lot of schools have already spent more than the budget that they had for PPE. That's an ongoing issue. So I think as a government, if we want to avoid that strike, that's on us, not necessarily on the teachers. Their concerns are real and we should be listening to them.
Brenda, do you think that it's a real threat or do you think they're just loading the gun in advance of going into negotiations?
Well, I mean, the implication seems to be that they don't want to strike, but that they have no option but to put up to and including strike action on the ballot paper. I think threatening strike, unless you're absolutely prepared to go for it, is extremely foolish. And talk about tone deaf. You know, to threaten to strike and to close the schools after all that parents have been through is really unconscionable, even to make the threat. I heard the Minister for Education on, I think it was Drive Time yesterday evening, saying that 85% of the country's schools have had no engagement with public health. Schools are just about the safest place you can be. And I think there is a perception, however unfair it might be, that there's a level of exceptionalism here amongst the teachers that unlike other frontline workers, if that's what they say they are, that they seem to believe that they are entitled to have their health and their well-being preferred over everybody else's. I mean, let's not forget that teachers are in that cohort of very protected public sector workers who have not lost one penny in wages throughout this entire crisis. And for them to be threatening to close the schools and potentially putting the incomes and livelihoods of self-employed parents at risk is unconscionable. I know they have concerns. Everybody has concerns. Get over it. But this is not the way to go about it. This emergency calls for cooperation rather than threats. And, you know, as a parent with a kid in secondary school, Philip, like a lot of parents in my position, I tend to suspect, maybe cynically, maybe unfairly, that there's very little teachers' grievances that can't be addressed by throwing money at them.
Well, you know, first of all, I will say that I think that the schools reopening has to be one of the few massive achievements that have happened over the last 6 months. And that has happened on the backs of teachers. So when teachers hear a message from NPHET, where NPHET is saying to the general working population, stay at home, and yet there's a separate message given to them, they think differently. I think that it's the schools need to remain open. But the government also need to make sure that teachers are comfortable in their working environment. So up till now, I understand that teachers weren't getting information about the status of the illness in schools directly from NPHET. They were getting it through the department. I welcome the fact that the government has allowed for NPHET to meet directly with teachers' unions, and I believe that's going to be ongoing into the future. But if you're a teacher in a secondary school where, you know, most of the kids are nearly adults at that stage, there's 1,300 children moving about the place in narrow corridors, shoulder to shoulder, well, of course, you know, people are going to worry. I think in the future, what the government needs to do is let teachers know exactly what the status of the illness is in their schools.
And maybe not just the teachers. I don't know, did you hear Barry Lenehan reporting earlier on in the programme about the Facebook group with 117,000 members who are exchanging information, and we don't know whether they're correct in the information that they're exchanging or not, about the COVID status of schools and of individual pupils. Clearly there's a desire or a thirst for information and knowledge out there, Brenda Power, but that information really needs to come from the state and from nowhere else, doesn't it?
It does, but I mean, again, you know, it does appear, I saw a report again from HSE today saying that the schools are they're extremely resilient. They're holding up well. They are safe places to be. And let's not forget, you know, when you say, well, it's as Father said, you know, we expect teachers to go out when the general advice is not to go out. We also expect shop assistants and checkout assistants to go out. We expect hospital porters to go out. We expect people who are paid an awful lot less than teachers to take risks that are arguably far greater. If you're handling goods through a supermarket checkout that has been handled by somebody who may not be wearing a mask and may not have washed their hands, you're at far greater risk, I suggest. But nobody is saying, well, those people should be allowed to stay at home. Or should be allowed to threaten to close down every retail outlet until they're satisfied and comfortable.
I think the schools are resilient and they are safe places to be because of the hard work of teachers. And I think that a key thing here is communication. And I have heard from schools in my own constituency that they are, you know, a little bit frustrated with the level of communication they get from the department. And I think we could do better there. I also think, actually, far from maybe a Facebook group, what we do need to look at, and perhaps NEFID should look at this, and when it came up on the health committee, is communicating to children. Like, talk to children. They are living this pandemic too. They're in the middle of COVID also, and we cannot hide it from them. We're well past the stage when we can hide it from them. So I think we do need to look at a communication campaign for children to explain to them what is happening and talk to them on their level about what COVID means in their school.
But, Patter, it seems to be, and I can only take this texter to the programme at face value, but we had somebody who was both a teacher and a parent of pupils in the same school saying that the information that they were getting about the number of COVID cases in the school as a teacher was completely different to the information that they were getting as a parent. Should that be the case? Is there any possible justification for it?
There's no justification for it. And I spoke to a teacher this morning who told me exactly the same thing, that teachers don't know the prevalence of the illness in their school or their class, that that information is being withheld for them from them. And that's absolutely wrong. On one level, we have, to a certain extent, a crescendo of panic within, you know, when we discuss this particular illness. It is a serious illness. We need to do our best to keep it down. I'm not saying it isn't. So, but we shouldn't be shocked then when particular workers who are in the front line, who are out there, are very want to be very careful about their working environment. I think that we need to have a calm understanding and discussion, both inside government, in the media, and in the workplace, on what's happening.
And does voting for strike action strike you as a calm measure?
Well, I want to see schools remain open. And for schools to remain open, I think teachers have the rights to the full information of the prevalence of the illness in their schools. They don't have that at the moment.
OK, I want to move on to the mother and baby homes. NASA, your party colleague Roderick O'Gorman admitted yesterday that he had mishandled this. How did you all get the pitch so wrong on this?
Well, I definitely think that we got it wrong on this. For me, this was always a multi-stage process of a number of pieces of legislation. And what that legislation was trying to achieve is A, to make the report available, and it has been delayed for quite a long time, to B, hold on to that database because previous commissions have destroyed the databases, and C, make sure that that database was available to everybody who needed it in the right way. Now,
the vote a couple of weeks ago... Big broad brushstrokes here. You were dealing with a group of people who have been... felt that they have been whitewashed over, forgotten and covered up for years. And here you were saying right from the outset, and there's a large swathe of information that you're just never going to get access to again. That was never going to end well, was it?
But I suppose I would say that that wasn't the as a, that wasn't what we were suggesting. What we were suggesting was the vote on last week on Thursday would deal with those first two issues. They would save the database and would make the report available, and then we would have to have following legislation to deal with making it accessible. Now, the position of the AG in the last few days has made that process more straightforward, perhaps. But I do hear a kind of an opinion at the moment that, well, this is a done deal now. And I would caution people against that, because this is not necessarily about this government making a decision on information either way. This is about unpicking a legacy of secrecy within this state, a legacy of, legislation which is about hiding things, which is about thwarting people's access, which is not about transparency. And that is not going to be a simple thing to unpick. And we definitely need legislation around adoptees and their rights to information. But there are also things, this is wider than mother and baby homes, there's also things like the McAleese archive that we need to now ask, you know, how does that relate with GDPR?
Because this is a legacy of secrecy, the first port of call should have been a consultation with the people who have been affected by this. And a proper consultation, they should have been on the inside of the process, and they were put on the outside of the process. The second port of call, I look at the government's PR release. It says there was detailed reflection at cabinet. Now, that's PR speak for a U-turn. That detailed reflection did not happen before the legislation went through. And actually, legislation is the space for detailed reflection. That's where we get to put up amendments and have those discussed. But at the start of that process, Roderick O'Gorman himself said that he will not accept any amendment from the opposition. So without listening to a word of the reasoning behind those amendments, he shut down the possibility of reflecting on that at the time. Even with what the government has come out in the last few days, it looks like that it's still going to be a very windy road for people to access information, that that information will have to be independent of any other individual, a mother, a father, a potential sibling, rights to their privacy before they can access it. That means a section of society will remain an other. A section of society will not have access to their identity in all its
Wrong. But that speaks to how complex it is, and I think you're right that the key mistake here was not to have people on the inside of the process. And in the last week, we've had incredible engagement, and that engagement has sometimes been painful. But it's really important that the people who made their voices heard, and the kind of feedback that we had on you know, Twitter and Facebook and all these places, that remains, because this is a longer process. This is a more, you know, a wider issue.
Brenda, you're being left out here. Did you want to say something?
I wanted to agree with Nata and Pather there that I think communication and consultation would have been key to averting this from the very outset. As soon as people heard a 30-year moratorium on this information being released, of course they were going to think, this is more of it. This is exactly what we've been suffering all along with people, you know, brushing the facts and our stories under the carpet. The difficulty is this is much more complex than simply anybody wanting to hide information for 30 years. There are conflicting rights here, and there are concerns about the ability to hold inquiries in future about the prejudicing of future hearings or trials, and also about the rights of maybe mothers who may not want to be contacted by the children they gave up to adoption for adoption. So, you know, this was always a matter, though, that could have been resolved with better communication, better consultation. Okay.
I can't help just worrying if I can. There is funding potentially to be given to people who have lived in mother and baby homes, who haven't had an apology individually themselves, or who haven't had compensation. The cabinet discussed that in the last week. And, you know, it's hard not to be involved in politics for so long and not to feel that that also has an element in this whole process of giving information out.
Your party, NASA, has been quite damaged by this, with councillors leaving, Lorna Bogue most recently leaving, she said, over the handling of the mother and baby homes. Do you take that at face value, or do you think that Lorna was always going to leave?
No, I take that at face value. Lorna is a very valued colleague by me, and she's been a great support to me. And I think she has very important points to make about the way the party is operating. And so she's a big loss. And I think the problem for many members and for councillors in this case is that this is so opposite of how we view ourselves. And so to be embroiled in something like this, where we have massively failed and failed to listen to voices of people, to be honest with you, we tend to think of ourselves as representing and speaking up for. And we do have a good record in terms of transparency and data. So it has been incredibly difficult for members and for councillors.
Are there two Green parties now? Have you split effectively?
Well, when people leave, they have split. They have left. I'm not gone. I haven't split from the Green Party. There might be a sigh of relief if I did from some quarters. And I personally have a very clear vision about what Green politics should be. It's not always reflected in this government, but I am not prepared to give that ground away yet.
Is this not? I mean, is addressing the climate crisis not the most important thing facing the entire planet and the Green Party? And you just have to hold your nose on all of the other issues that are part and parcel of being in government.
Absolutely not, because one is not distinct from the other. There is no climate justice without social justice. This is something that affects people globally, but also here in Ireland. If we can't get housing right, if we can't get energy right, if we can't get transport right, we'll leave people behind. And no solution to climate justice is enduring unless we get that right.
Is anybody here looking forward to US presidential election night, or is this now something to actually dread? Brenda?
Oh, God. I mean, talk about Halloween. This is going to be a far more terrifying few hours than anything I can imagine. There is so much at stake here. And it does appear, Philip, as though it's still very much in the balance. You know, I mean, there's confidence, I know, in the Democratic camp, but it's it's getting closer as far as I can see by the minute, and especially in some of the swing states. And then there's a suspicion that, like the shy Tories of a few years ago, there may be shy Trumpers who are not telling the pollsters how they intend to vote. You know, you see these queues of up to 11 hours at polling stations, and you have to wonder, I know the speculation is that they're mostly Democrats who are eager, to put it mildly, for a change. But it's just as likely that it includes a good portion of Trumpers who are afraid to see the back of them. So it is literally all to play for. It'll be a night to watch the telly through your fingers, I think, if you're prepared to stay up that late.
Moving on, Patter, do you think churches should be reopened?
I do. I think that the figures that we're looking at the moment have shown that level 3 restrictions have had an effect. I do think that the country was too fast to jump into level 5 restrictions. There is a fall in a lot of the key indicators around COVID. I also believe that we should look at the locus of transmission of the illness, and I have never seen churches...
Is that a populist position? Because, I mean, you know exactly what the scientists are saying.
Well, it isn't, actually. If you look at Ireland as an outlier in this, I don't think there's any other country in Europe where the churches are closed. There's 3 countries in the world where a Christian church is not open. That's North Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Ireland. Ireland is a significant, even in the north of Ireland, that has a higher rate. So I do believe that there's a necessity for restrictions, but they should be balanced.
Okay, just before we go, quick word on that and response, NASA.
I think we need to be very careful about those kind of decisions. But I have to say, the kind of cohort that would go to mass, they're already experiencing isolation. So maybe it is something we should think about.
All right. NASA Harrigan, Padda Tobin and Brenda Power, thank you all very much.